Everything you're hearing is from the Home Depot. From the baseboards and nails to these throw pillows. Even those super soft sheets. Because now at the Home Depot, you can get everything for your bedroom. From wooden nightstands to modern benches. Save up to 25% on select bedroom furniture. Plus free and flexible delivery and easy in-store returns. Shop decor now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items, $45 or more. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today, we're going to be talking about eating to improve your fertility. This diets and food choices are something that I'm infinitely fascinated by. I hope you are as well. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear. Why is it that cooked foods, especially soups, the slow simmering type, why would that have any impact on fertility?
So there's two reasons for that. So the first is what we talked about in terms of the digestive fire. And, of course, anything slowly simmered in water that's warm or even hot is a lot easier for our bodies to digest and absorb. There's also a correspondence chart in Chinese medicine where the reproductive organs are correspond to the element of water. So like we talked about the pool of water, and anything slowly simmered in water is going to be very, very replenishing to our baseline energies.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host as well as the director of Creating a Family. You can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring has a program, a free program they want you to know about, My Fertility Navigator. This program offers one-on-one support for women who are trying to get pregnant and have questions, don't know what to do next, things such as that. Once you enroll in My Fertility Navigator, you are assigned a personalized guidance from a guide, I guess I should say, from a live, dedicated, what they call fertility navigator. He or she can provide you information about fertility, including lists of nearby fertility centers, information about how to finance or to afford fertility treatment, as well as discussing the many fertility treatment options that are available. To get more information, you can go to their website, myfertilitynav.com/CAF. Don't forget the /CAF part, because that lets them know that you heard about them from us. Today, we're going to be talking about foods and diet that may improve your fertility. We'll be talking with Katherine Simmons Flynn. She is the author of Cooking for Fertility, as well as the founder of FertileFoods.com. Since 2005, she has worked with women and men to improve their fertility diet and to support their chances of conceiving. Welcome, Katherine, to Creating a Family. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you, Dawn. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Okay, you start in the book with the book Cooking for Fertility. I should give the name again. You start with the premise that subfertility is often the result of less than optimum general health. I mean, that's common sense. That does make sense, that healthy people are going to have a better chance of conceiving. But have you also read research that supports this, in addition to the fact that it makes good common sense?
Well, absolutely. And there's a lot of great research coming out, especially in the past 10 years, specifically about nutrient deficiencies that are causing issues with fertility. And also, when I work with men and women in the fertility consultations, there is a lot of sub-issues that they're dealing with. For instance, a condition of an autoimmune disorder can create a level of inflammation in the body that then is causing the infertility issue. So more and more I'm finding wonderful studies popping up about the value of nutrition and lifestyle changes especially too in the line of epigenetics and nutrigenomics, which really are showing us that, you know, what we eat and what we do on a day-to-day basis actually changes the expression of our genes. So,
you know,
a lot is in our control.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There seems to be a resurgent of interest in doing research, or interest in researching, I should say, the impact of food and lifestyle, which, as I said at the beginning, is just something I'm fascinated by. If for no other reason than it's one of the few things we have some control over. And in a thing that, in an area that we have so little control, which if you're experiencing infertility, you feel like you're totally out of control. Now, you rely on the dietary theories found in traditional Chinese medicine. Can you, I realize that people get doctorates in traditional Chinese medicine, and so what I'm asking is pretty difficult, but could you explain the basics, kind of give us the crib note version of what are the dietary theories that TCM espouses?
Yes, absolutely. I love Chinese medicine. I first came upon it working with Randine Lewis, who wrote The Infertility Cure, and I studied with Paul Pitchford, who wrote the beautiful book Healing with Whole Foods, and really talked about the healing benefits of the foods themselves based on Chinese medicine. So what I think is wonderful about Chinese medicine and dietary theory is that it looks at the whole body, but you approach the dietary part from the spleen-pancreas connection. So in the book, I talk a lot about spleen-qi digestion, which is basically our digestive fire, so our ability to absorb and distribute nutrients within the body. So when we strengthen the spleen-qi digestion, naturally all of the other organs are strengthened in the body because they're able to get more nutrients. And so the analogy I like to use for spleen qi digestion is if you picture your stomach like a cooking pot and everything you put in your mouth either supports or impedes your digestion. So so you have this cooking pot, you have this fire underneath. Now picture you add in some warm soup or some room temperature water versus ice cream. Ice cream's a great example, or ice cold water. What happens with these ice-cold foods is it shuts down the digestive fire, and then your body has to work even harder to warm it back up. It can do it. It's not impossible. But what we want to do for fertility particularly is to make the digestive process with great ease as possible. So if that answered your question, Dawn, a little bit about the basis of the digestion?
Yeah, and we don't normally, in Western medicine, we don't necessarily think much of the spleen. Also the role of the kidney. You talk about that in the book. And how does the kidney play into, I don't know if it plays into digestion or just into general fertility support?
Sure. Well, one other thing I should say when you're talking about Chinese medicine and dietary theory is that the spleen represents so much more than just the organ. So not only is the spleen responsible for digestion and absorption of nutrients, it also governs immunity, it governs our thought process, our muscles, so the strength of our muscles. So then you can look to all these different areas of your body to see if you might have a deficiency in spleen qi, which is a deficiency in energy in the digestive process. So then moving along to the kidneys are actually the paired organ of the adrenals and the reproductive organs. So when we're born, all three of those form together. So I like to refer to those as kind of the baseline energies. And the analogy that I love to use for them is it's almost as though your reproductive function is like a pool of water. And every day, we go out in the world and we trade that pool of water for activities we do during the day. And some of those activities are naturally heating and some of them are cooling and replenishing. So heating activities would be extra stress, toxic relationships, too much coffee, not enough sleep, over-exercising. Replenishing cooling activities would be, getting enough rest, drinking enough water, maybe a meditation, massage, acupuncture, so anything that feels like it's building you up. And so in our society, we have a lot of heating activities. So the kidneys often get drained, which results in subfertility conditions. So oftentimes, a diagnosis of either kidney essence deficiency, kidney yang or kidney yin deficiency, we need to look at what we're doing on a daily basis to bring about the relaxation response. And so that's the first place I look. How are we exercising? You know, is our exercise pushing us too hard, or are we keeping it at a level where we feel like we're replenishing ourselves? And then finally, there's some wonderful foods in Chinese dietary therapy that you can add in to bolster the kidneys. So those would be deep greens, so chlorophyll foods, you know, in the spinach, chard, kale, or any of the green, deep green seaweed, the spirulina, the chlorophyll, the wheatgrass that we hear so much about with fertility. May also be black beans, seaweed, some of these things. So each organ system in Chinese medicine has a specific set of foods and practices that go along to bolster them. And the diagnosis is something that, you know, you could either learn in consultation with a nutrition therapist that specializes in Chinese medicine, or, of course, from an acupuncturist, because that's a beautiful combination.
Okay, what I want to do, we in the common medium, we hear of a lot of things that are supposed to be either good or bad for us. And so I'm just going to go down a list of things. And have you tell us whether or not they, from the standpoint of the traditional Chinese dietary theories in TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, whether these things enhance fertility or detract from fertility. Let's start with something that I dearly love, sugar. What is the role of sugar in fertility, or I suppose infertility?
Well, sugar is a popular one, right, because we use it a lot in society. It gives us that kind of boost, and it also can, and you know, activate the serotonin, so it's something that we often reach for. And sugar cravings are a sign of spleen qi deficiency that we talked about, and also a sign of blood sugar imbalance. So the rule of thumb for fertility is we want to avoid refined sugars and artificial sweeteners completely, and choose more natural sources of sugar. So, sugar from fruit, for instance, and then using natural sugars in moderation. When I wrote the cookbook, agave nectar was something that was very popular, but as we know, sugars and foods go through their cycles. So
They definitely do.
Right? You know, you hear one day stevia is the favorite, and then there's something, you know, going on there. But what I like to say is the most natural forms of sugar can be used in moderation. So honey, maple syrup, organic sugars in baking. My absolute favorite right now is coconut sugar. It has a wonderfully low glycemic index, and it comes in different forms like a syrup and also a simple sugar that's easy to replace in baking. And my approach to this is kind of the 80-20 factor. So if we do anything where we're completely over-restricting ourselves, it's not going to be sustainable diet and lifestyle changes. So the idea is that when we get our body more in balance, we tend to crave less sugars, if that makes sense. So it really, the sugar piece is one of moderation, one of using the best ingredients possible and making sure your blood sugar is in balance. And I can talk about that if you want to understand a little bit more.
Yeah, before you do that, let's talk a little about the glycemic levels, the glycemic index. Because everybody may not be aware of it, because what I'm hearing you say is that you want to aim for low glycemic sweeteners. So explain what you mean by glycemic, or high or low glycemic.
So the glycemic index is an index from 0 to 100, and all foods are placed on this index. And anything over kind of 50, 70, they say, is considered high glycemic, and anything below is on the lower glycemic. So you can Google and pull up a list of foods and kind of see where some of your favorite foods are falling. One example that I like to use is the difference between a table sugar, which I believe is kind of around 60, and some of the fruit sugars, which is a lot lower, around a 20. So it just shows you that you won't get as high of a glycemic hit from a fruit as you would from a table sugar. Another example would be mashed potatoes. They fall in at a 95 on the glycemic index, which is quite high.
Yeah.
And yams, or colorful potatoes, are around 44. It's still important to note that at 44, yams can still be too high glycemic for certain conditions like PCOS. So it really has to be how you eat. You need to pair a protein and a carbohydrate. People who eat something like a donut or a bagel and an orange juice for breakfast are going to experience a big spike in their blood sugar. Then it drops way low, body produces insulin and cortisol to bring it to baseline. Those are both fat-depositing hormones. When that loop happens over and over again, you're in a situation of blood sugar imbalance and insulin resistance.
What is the current theory on stevia? That was something that we don't hear quite as much about it now, but it was certainly the darling a couple of years ago. Is that in favor or out of favor now?
So I love organic green stevia, and I also, you know, this is a plant that's been around for, you know, forever, right? And so it's extremely low glycemic. It also contains chlorophyll because it's a green plant, which we talked about is so wonderful for fertility. And somewhere that I see it popping up a lot these days is in soda replacements. So when we were talking about sugar, one of the areas that I think is kind of a no-go is, you know, diet sodas. There's lots of chemicals in there, in the sweeteners. There's one company that I've seen called Zevia that makes all those different flavors of soda with stevia in it, and I like to provide that as a recommendation of an alternative for people because a lot of it is including the things you love, but you know, finding better alternatives. So I think, too, for sweetening tea and things like that, the green organic stevia is the best choice, either liquid or powder.
Okay. All right. Now, salt. What is the role? I guess I should say that's another thing that I like. I also think that without salt, a lot of foods are just very bland, but what is the thinking from the traditional Chinese medicine standpoint of the benefit or harm for salt?
Okay, well, when we think about salt, we're thinking of the sodium-potassium balance, of course. So that can be an individual diagnosis of folks, too, if they've gotten some blood work done. So some people aren't recommended to have too much salt, certainly. But in general, I love the Himalayan pink sea salt. I think that that's a great choice for flavoring. And then from a Chinese medicine standpoint, the best choice is actually seaweed. So seaweed provides the same minerals. You can actually get a salt shaker that's made with calcium dulse that has kind of a similar taste to the salt that you might try. I don't know if you've tried that one, Dawn. And then also, it's worthwhile. It's great. And then also, for the benefits of the healthy minerals from the salt, using seaweed, so kelp or dulse, when you're cooking, so that might be a big pot of soup or some grains, anything that you're slowly simmering in water, if you get some dried kelp and you cut it up into little strips, pop it in while you're cooking, the meal is fortified by the really strong minerals from the seaweed. So that's kind of the best case scenario for salt from Chinese medicine therapy.
And generally from my experience, adding seaweed, that you can remove it after the fact, it really doesn't change the flavor. So it adds I hadn't really thought salty, but yes, it adds the minerals from it But it doesn't significantly change the flavor for people who think that they wouldn't care for seaweed.
Right, and if you cut it up small enough, nobody even notices it's there, right? So you can really cut it up into tiny little pieces, and then you don't have to fish it out of the dish afterwards.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, yeah. Now, wheat. Certainly we're in a gluten-free phase right now. Fad, supposedly be another word. So what is the approach from TCM and fertility for wheat and or gluten?
So the idea is basically to take out any foods that cause a level of inflammation in the body. So it's somewhat of an elimination diet, where if you remove wheat and gluten for, 6 weeks to 3 months, you really get a chance to see how different your body feels. When I wrote the cookbook, it was wheat-free, with mentions of gluten-free, but as the research continues to build, we've gone more towards the way of gluten-free and even grain-free, especially in conditions of autoimmune conditions. Grain-free can be even preferable to gluten-free. And the reason, I talk a lot about the 80-20 for pleasure, but gluten is one of the things that you really need to cut out 100%. Otherwise, it remains in your bloodstream and continues to wreak havoc. And what gluten is doing in your body can be very subtle and not even maybe noticeable because you're used to it. So it can range from digestive disturbances, of course, the inflammation. It can cause joint pain, migraine headaches, skin issues can clear up, but it really has to be a concerted effort for at least 6 weeks to 3 months. And then I find people usually maybe try and add back in, and they find they get a food hangover, meaning, that pesky thing that was going on, maybe it's a dull headache, or maybe they notice their digestion isn't working as well as it should. So gluten is definitely one of those things that I say 100%. And if you have an underlying autoimmune condition, you may even want to go to grain-free or the paleo, which is also pretty popular. All of these kind of foods go through their moments. So that's definitely one of the ones I think 100% gluten-free.
Now, you're not saying necessarily 100% grain-free unless you've got a reason. And what would indicate that you would want to be 100% grain-free?
So I find some of the conditions with autoimmune, so the inflammatory conditions that are diagnosed, let's say rheumatoid arthritis would be one of them, Hashimoto's. Some of these conditions will definitely benefit from taking away the grains. I don't say grain-free for everyone because I also think grains have their benefits. Quinoa has the highest level of protein. Brown rice is one of the most studied foods ever with all the vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants. And they're also believed to be very common in Chinese dietary therapy. So a lot of what we talked about in terms of the spleen, not only governing our digestion, but also our thoughts, there's a lot of anxiety that comes along with a diagnosis of infertility in particular. So sometimes some of the grains, like a gluten-free oatmeal for breakfast or a little side of quinoa during the day, those are actually really common to the system and nutrient dense. So choosing gluten-free grains is the first option, and then with more serious autoimmune conditions, exploring a grain-free diet, but definitely a gluten-free.
And the grains that have gluten in it, in addition to wheat, which is obvious, would be things such as barley, kamut, oat, rye, spelt. All of those also have gluten. So you would want to focus your grains, if you're trying to avoid gluten, on amaranth, buckwheat, flaxseed, whatever. Oh, quinoa, you mentioned that. Millet. Oh, and brown rice, you mentioned that. So those would be the ones you would be focusing on if you are wanting to keep grains but wanting to avoid gluten.
Correct.
All right.
You could also add in gluten-free oats They just have to specifically be gluten-free because they can be cross-contaminated.
How do you get gluten-free oats? I guess I don't understand how you would take the gluten out of an oat.
Right. So oats aren't naturally gluten and cross-contaminated.
Oh, so, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah.
So oats themselves do not contain gluten, so as long as you are careful with where you that you buy them from a place that prevents cross-contamination, you'd be okay. Is that correct?
Right. You just want to choose one that was labeled gluten-free.
Huh. I didn't realize that. Okay, cool. All right. Now, we got a question that's going to lead us into this next one. This is from Lois. She says, I have been a vegetarian since I was 16. I am now 32 and have been trying to get pregnant for 2 years. I'd love any information on vegetarianism and fertility. I thought I would jump in. There has been some fascinating research that we've reported on about the importance of protein in conception. In fact, I know of the doctor that we interviewed on this show that was had done some of the research won't take people as a patient unless they agree to have, and I don't remember specifically, we could, you can search on our site, creatingafamily.org, infertility and protein, and you'll pull up a fair amount, including the actual research, but I believe it's at least 30% protein. I honestly don't remember, however, from that research whether it he had dug deeper to see if the protein, it was, if there was a benefit for the protein coming from animal products, or if vegetarian sources of protein were equal. I would guess that vegetarian would be protein is protein, but I'm not sure about that. Anyway, let me ask you, so from a traditional Chinese medicine standpoint, what is the role of protein?
So the role of protein is very important, not only for fertility, but also through pregnancy. And part of the reason is a lot of the animal proteins in particular contain the good B vitamins. So a lot of times when I get clients that come as vegetarians, especially when they've been vegetarian for a long period of time, there may be a deficiency in B vitamins, although I know most vegetarians are likely taking a B complex. In that case, I always want to make sure they're taking a methylated form of B complex. So that's the methyl folate and the methyl cholobin, which is more absorbable into the body. Sometimes there's also an iron deficiency because, again, a lot of the iron, I mean, certainly you can get it from lentils and black beans, but a lot of the iron is also from some of the red meats, as we know. And so when I work with someone who's experiencing fertility issues that is vegetarian, I mean, we definitely make sure that they're loading up on all of the, you know, the black beans, the lentils that I just mentioned, all of the good sources of protein. I also have a conversation usually with them about whether their decision is philosophical, so what the basis is for why they are vegetarian, and whether they are open to introducing any forms of animal products. So certain vegetarians may eat eggs. Certain vegetarians, even they call them pescatarians, you know, they'll eat salmon or fish. And then certain people I've worked with, it really has to do with the kidneys, so a feeling of depletion. So certain people are willing to add in things like bone broth. They may not feel like they're able to, you know, start eating red meat and things like that, but bone broth as a soup form can seem palatable to them. And what I sometimes see with that is that it fills them right up because it's often a kidney deficiency, so that we're talking about those baseline energies, and they immediately feel a boost in energy. Some people, of course, are not open to that, so I never push it because I definitely respect, you know, respect that philosophical decision. So another area would be fermented foods. So getting enough fermented foods in the diet, building up the gut lining, getting the good B vitamins that way. So those are kind of a few options, but definitely the methylated B vitamins.
Okay, for vegetarians. And for someone who is not a vegetarian, is there a hierarchy of protein sources that you would recommend specifically if they are trying to conceive?
So I really think first portion size, you know, Chinese medicine dietary theory, it's definitely not the American standard American diet, right, with the full plate of steak and then the side of the corn and the mashed potatoes. So when we're looking at a plate, half your plate is going to be filled with steamed, grilled, cooked veggies, colorful as possible, and then a palm-sized portion of protein. So that could be from the vegetarian source of the beans and lentils. Salmon is probably my most favorite for the good, healthy fat and omegas. And then anything to do with animal proteins, you always want to make sure it's organic and grass-fed to avoid any of the interference of the hormones. So, you know, organic grass-fed chicken, grass-fed beef or lamb. We don't recommend pork. Pork tends to be the most toxic, and so we usually leave that aside.
Okay. All right. So fish, and the fish in specific that you mentioned is salmon. What is your thinking on tofu?
So tofu is a refined source of soy. Of course, we hear a lot about not overdoing the phytoestrogens, especially with estrogen-dominant conditions. We live kind of in an estrogen-dominant world, especially because we're surrounded by so many toxins. So the xenoestrogens in our environment, and then the phytoestrogens, which are the refined soy sources. So unrefined soy sources like miso soup, tempeh, those are fine. Tofu is something that I would just do in moderation. It's not something that would be a daily staple because of the phytoestrogens.
Okay. How about dairy? I thought it was interesting that you recommend whole fat over skim. I've read some of the same research, the Harvard Nurses study. Has been fascinating in reporting of that. So why don't you talk a little bit about why you recommend whole fat dairy product over skim or even 2% types?
Sure. Well, we know a lot about fat being so important and so great for fertility. And in years past, we were kind of a society that was a little bit afraid of fat. We created fat with gaining weight. I think it's really important to note, as just kind of a little aside, I love this statistic from Weight Watchers that when people are having trouble losing weight, they have them eat half an avocado a day, and that gets them over the hump. So kind of just like a different perspective on fat. So whole fat definitely being preferable than skim. When the nurses study came out, though, there was a Today Show interview, I think it was, and there was a woman, I had a client who saw it, and she said, "Oh, I hate ice cream, but I'm making my husband go get it for me every night because I saw, based on the nurse's study, they said whole fat milk, and they mentioned ice cream." And I said, "Oh, well, not exactly that, right, because that will put down the digestive fire. And actually, cow dairy is a lot more complicated in its protein structure. So it's difficult for our bodies to break down. So I actually recommend clients prefer goat dairy products or alternatives like almond, coconut milk, hemp milk to cow dairy due to the complicated protein structure that can create a level of dampness in the body, which is just kind of a fancy way to say kind of shutting down the digestive fire.
Well, I have a question about that because I was going to ask you about some of the popular milk alternatives, soy, almond, coconut, whatever, any of the nuts, cashew, whatever. When you read their list of ingredients, they are chock full of chemicals, but really in essence, it's supplements. because they have very little nutritional value on their own because they're highly processed. And so the only way that they get the nutrition in is through supplementation. And as somebody who's trying to eat as natural as possible, I have been avoiding them. They don't seem particularly healthy. They seem fairly artificial. So what are your thoughts on that? Am I all wrong on that?
Nope, I don't think so at all. You know, so specifically a few years ago, rice milk in particular, I really thought that was, you know, it had a lot of brown rice syrup in it. It was much too sweet. So I definitely go for the coconut milk. There's some particular brands, and they're often found in the refrigerator section, so not the ones that are actually on the shelf. And if you look at the ingredient panels in those, and I'm blanking on the name, it's an actual big bottle, and some ingredients are better than others. So you always have to check the side panel. And to tell you the honest to God truth, my favorite is definitely goat kefir.
Uh-huh.
So kefir, obviously, with the fermentation, is so wonderful for the gut, and we're learning more and more about the importance of having a healthy gut and restoring the healthy probiotics. So that's my go-to. And then I just choose very carefully with the milk alternatives, or, you know, make your own is another option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, all of these can be made, and then you can choose to add supplementation or not, and so you can avoid that. Let me remind everybody that you are listening to Creating a Family, and today we are talking with Catherine Flynn. She is the author of Cooking for Fertility, and we're talking about, well, cooking for fertility. We're talking about foods to eat to enhance your fertility. Creating a Family is supported by our partners, and it is through these partners and their support that we're able to bring you this show. Some of our wonderful sponsors include IntegraMed Fertility. They are the largest network of fertility practices in the country. By combining the latest innovations in the reproductive sciences with compassionate and customized treatment plans, IntegraMed practices are able to provide the very best possible care. And you can find a list of their clinics by going to their website, and you can find those that are in an IntegraMed Fertility Clinic. All right, so we've talked about fats, and we've talked about protein and dairy in specific. What about coffee and tea? It's been interesting. There's always a lot of research, in particular on coffee, and because my husband loves coffee, he tends to listen and hear. I say, you know, you don't ever hear any of that. You don't notice any research on anything other than coffee, and you never notice the research that says anything bad about coffee. But you give him he's like a magnet. He can find a research study that will say, you know, 5 cups of coffee a day, you know, increases, you know, prevents Alzheimer's or increases longevity or whatever, and he can't wait to tell me about it. So it's a very popular topic because I suspect coffee is such a popular drink. So let's talk about, let's start with coffee, and then we'll move on to the different teas.
Okay.
So coffee, how does coffee impact from the traditional Chinese medicine standpoint, fertility?
Okay, I think that's so funny, by the way, because that is the nature of all studies, right? You can find them on both sides. But
yep.
For fertility, and especially if you're looking for it, and I do have to say this is one of the parts in my consultations that I have to tread very lightly with, because coffee isn't just used as a boost to get through the day, but it's actually part of a ritual,
you know,
the smell, the routine first thing in the morning.
It's a pleasure.
It's
a simple pleasure.
Exactly.
You know, Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. It's part of a routine. So there's definitely studies that came out, the Kaiser Permanente study in particular, that came out showing that caffeine could contribute to miscarriage. And they didn't single out coffee. They also included, you know, hot chocolate and caffeinated beverages across the board. So from a Chinese medicine perspective, coffee would fall into one of those, the heating category. So So when we were talking about the baseline energies and either replenishing or heating, so taking away from the energies. And coffee definitely does that. It's heating. It can also impact the liver that's responsible for, of course, processing the hormones for fertility. So it's definitely one of those things, if you are not overly attached to it, that we recommend really kind of backing off caffeine in general. This can be a difficult thing to do when you're used to it. I think it's a worthwhile exercise, though, because it can really give you a clear picture of your baseline energies. You know, we use things during our day like coffee and even over-exercising to get kind of a false lift. But what we're really doing is we're borrowing from those baseline energies and taking from our, you know, fertility. So oftentimes I will recommend kind of a moderate approach. You know, could we switch to decaf? Is that a possibility? Can we wean off? I mean, people who are really into their coffee can get headaches if they just stop cold turkey. So how can we do this in a way that's pleasurable? And this is an area where we're saying, you know, you can never have coffee again. I always say this is part of the 80-20. If you're at your favorite cafe in Italy, that's a stretch, but, you know, make sure you enjoy, you know, on the weekend. Can you do decaf? And then I do recommend for the period of time, especially with fertility issues, to choose herbal teas if possible. I even went so far as to create an herbal tea for fertility for my clients because it was an issue. You know, what can I replace this with? And so I created an organic fertility tea as an option. So is that answering your question, Dawn? It's a kind of a tricky issue, but in general, yeah. It is taking away from the baseline energies. So it would be recommended to reduce caffeine and eliminate coffee for the period of time with, you know,
what
some
about,
pleasure instances.
What about green tea or black tea? That comes to mind not only because I love both, but also because I think in terms of tea being something that is, especially green tea, encouraged in TCM, traditional Chinese medicine in general. So how is it viewed, green tea and black tea, how are they viewed from a fertility standpoint?
So on the stepladder, so coffee would be kind of up high. Green and black tea still have caffeine, so you're still having that little hit to the adrenals. So it's still a little bit heating, but less so. So it can be a better option. There's some studies out there that show that green tea can deplete folate levels in the body.
Oh.
So there's a little bit of mixed research in that arena. It also has wonderful properties for boosting metabolism. So, again, if we're kind of, you know, embarking on this change anyway and we want to make some adjustments, that would be maybe on the stepladder of how to transition from coffee. So it would go caffeinated coffee, decaf coffee, caffeinated tea, and then ideally herbal teas with no caffeine.
Okay, got it. We got a question from Tanya. She said, I'm scheduled to start IVF priming this month for egg retrieval. I've read all kinds of books on what to eat / do when trying to get pregnant. However, I'm now wondering, what rules apply when using IVF and preparing for egg retrieval?
So just let me make sure I understand this correctly. Her IVF is coming up when?
She's starting to, it sounds like this month she's going to do an egg retrieval. So she is gearing up for an egg retrieval.
Okay.
So I don't know whether they'll do the IVF transfer at that point or not.
Right.
Oftentimes so now they don't do the transfer right away. They allow the body to reset before they freeze the embryos and then allow the
right.
body to reset. So I don't really know in her case.
Right. So the same principles apply. What would be really helpful is to follow a clean eating plan like the kind of elimination diet that's described in Cooking for Fertility. It's something that you can do ongoing through this process. What you don't want to do is you don't want to do any intense cleanse programs, if that makes sense. This is not a time to start, you know, a detox or anything that's going to feel harsh on your body. But gentle food changes can be incorporated. So, you know, replacing cow dairy with goat dairy, avoiding gluten, eliminating refined sugars and sweeteners, replacing coffee and caffeine with, you know, more hydrating and caffeine-free sources. All of these things can be done in conjunction, of course, the no alcohol, with your IVF and egg retrieval. And what that does is it supports the body to reduce inflammation. So inflammation is one of the things that can adversely impact implantation. So I would recommend doing these changes now. And it doesn't have to be perfect, you know, just any steps you can take to have a clean diet during this time where everything, the absorption, distribution of nutrients are happening with greatest ease.
Okay, and according to traditional Chinese medicine, cooked foods, especially those simmered slowly in liquids, i.e. soups, stews, things like that, increase fertility. Well, I loved reading that because I love both eating and making soups, particularly this time of year. Why is it that cooked foods, especially soups, the slow simmering type, why would that have any impact on fertility?
So there's two reasons for that. So the first is what we talked about in terms of the digestive fire. And, of course, anything slowly simmered in water that's warm or even hot is a lot easier for our bodies to digest and absorb. There's also a correspondence chart in Chinese medicine where the reproductive organs are correspond to the element of water. So like we talked about the pool of water, and anything slowly simmered in water is going to be very, very replenishing to our baseline energies.
Okay. And delicious, and particularly, and given that most of us are in cold or it's in the cold seasons right now, it would just feel so darn good. So all of those reasons. You say in the book that in Cooking for Fertility, you say that to support fertility, we should consume a mostly alkaline diet of vegetables, fruit, and sea vegetables, and limit acidic foods. Okay, so let's talk about some alkaline, what you mean by an alkaline diet. Give us some examples of vegetables, fruit, and sea vegetables, and proteins that would fall in the alkaline, or conversely, give us some that we should avoid because they are acidic.
Right. So alkaline and acidic balance is really that. So it's never going to be one or the other completely. So that has to do with kind of the description of how we look at our plate and the idea of really, you know, having half or more of your plate be colorful vegetables, right? So when we eat colorful vegetables, we're assured that we're getting, you know, the vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, phytonutrients that we need for our body to be naturally alkaline and also gently cleansing itself on a daily basis. So the purest of foods and organic would be that. So acidic foods, of course, would have to do with a lot of your meats. So, you know, the red meats in particular. And that's why we talk about limiting those to palm-sized portions. On the more alkaline level would definitely be some of the vegetarian sources of proteins, and some of the salmon would kind of be in the middle there. I always bring up salmon because it's one of my favorite sources of protein. It just has so much good fats and so good for you, anti-inflammatory. So it's more from that perspective. So making sure that you're getting a lot of the fruits and vegetables in the color of the rainbow. And one way to do this is to include a daily green smoothie. people often have a hard time getting as many greens as they would, so the deep chlorophyll of the greens in their diet. And one way to do that is to either use a green smoothie, even first thing in the morning as a snack, or even a breakfast. And when the greens are broken down, enzyme walls are broken down by the blending process, it makes that chlorophyll so wonderful and easily absorbed by our body. And the greens also help to really bring an alkaline environment in our bodies.
Okay. Give us the recipe. And there's a million recipes for green smoothies, I realize. But give us one of your favorite recipes for a green smoothie for someone who is trying for optimum health and or increasing fertility.
Sure. So I do a green smoothie almost every day, and I make this extremely simple. So one thing I do recommend is to have a good blender, because it really makes a difference when the smoothie is actually smooth. I think everybody's had that experience. And so a Vitamix or a Blendtec, both of those are good choices. Some of the ones that aren't as strong leave chunks, which makes it less palatable. So all that I say is to make sure you have a ratio of 3-1 of greens to fruit. So three handfuls, let's say, of spinach, chard, or kale, and I mix them up because they all have different properties. And then I like to add dark berries. So the lowest glycemic fruits are your dark berries, your apples, and your pears. So some combination of those. Let's say we did 3 cups. I'm making a lot of green smoothie in this example. 3 cups to 1 cup, just to show you the ratio. And then I always I go between using coconut milk or just straight-up water or coconut water. And the coconut water, I would say, definitely makes it a little bit sweeter for those of you who may not be used to green smoothies and might need it to be a little a sweeter to make it more palatable. And then I add a good, clean, vegan protein. The one I use is called Usana My Smart Shake. It has medium-chain fatty acids in the coconut oil. And that's why I like it, and very, very low sugar. So a good vegan protein, a few scoops of that. I like to add chlorophyll in addition to that, so you can get a liquid chlorophyll and add a few little droppers in. And then this is also a good time for those of you who are working with acupuncturists who might be recommending things like maca or some of the superfoods. It's also a good way to get some of those in too. So fill it up with your water, the top of the ingredients, pop on the top and blend and enjoy. And you can kind of play with this recipe to make it your own. You can use seasonal fruits and vegetables. Some people like to put pineapple. I wrote a lot about pineapple in the cookbook because it contains bromelain, which is a digestive enzyme that's also known to support implantation. So that's another fun thing to play with and put in the smoothies.
This time of year, do you use frozen vegetables?
So I don't use frozen spinach or chard or kale. I get that fresh from the grocery store. But I often use frozen fruits.
Yeah,
and
they're hard to get fresh.
Exactly. And we have to be really realistic, not to get, not to get hard on ourselves and restricted about what we can use. We need to use what's available. So frozen, unsweetened, organic fruits are great.
And say again the vegan source of protein. Will you give the name again?
Sure. The one that I use is Usana My Smart Shake. And again, because it has those medium-chain fatty acids in it, which is so good, and a low sugar content. And it just has a very subtle vanilla taste. So it goes nicely with all of the ingredients.
And spell that at the beginning. Usana, did you say?
Yeah, Usana. And
gotcha.
Anyone
Usana
is always welcome
shake.
To email me. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Okay, excellent. Let's, before I'm going to, I want to talk about one more of our partners, but then I'd like to move into general lifestyle habits that affect fertility. We won't spend a lot of time there, but I do want to just touch on them briefly. But before we do that, Let me remind you that this show is brought to you by the support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. And one of our wonderful partners is Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of a prospective sperm donor. And that way they can provide you with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. In addition to their donor sperm services, they also offer a full range of andrology and fertility preservation services. All right, let's just hit the high points. I think most people know, because it's probably general good, healthy lifestyle habits, but let's hit some that tell us lifestyle habits that can affect your fertility.
So we had touched on this at the beginning of anything that is kind of causing heat in the body or causing strain. And so, we talked about toxic relationships. We talked about toxic non-organic foods, lifestyle habits like not enough rest, not enough water, not enough nourishing foods, not eating enough times during the day. You know, we need the fuel to make it through the day. Excess and unnecessary medication use, alcohol, basically the idea of burning the candle at both ends. So what conversely is the most important is how often you can elicit the relaxation response during the day. And so I always say, make it your mantra as you're walking through the day. Am I nourishing myself? Am I replenishing myself? And, of course, we're going to have a combination of both activities because we live in the world. But the goal is to up the ante on the relaxation activities and that which nourishes you.
Okay. In general, and then I think you mentioned sleep, because we know that sleep is just really crucial for general optimum health, and more research is showing that as well. I enjoyed the book, the Cooking for Fertility. The first part of it is kind of an introduction to everything Catherine has been talking about today, but probably about the latter two-thirds are recipes. So, and there are also other recipes that you can find on her website, fertilefoods.com. So regardless of whether they're in the book or on the website, can you pick one or two recipes to tell us about that? This is awfully hard to say, if you could only do one thing, choose this recipe, but just choose two of your favorites and let's keep them relatively easy. Although I will say that most of the recipes in the book are easy. They are easy to prepare. You do not have to have a culinary degree by any stretch of the imagination. So give us two recipes.
No, not at all. Sure. So I'm gonna do one. We already talked about the green smoothie, which is possibly one of my favorite recipes and something that I really think people should be doing every single day to get those greens. But I also have another favorite recipe, which is bone broth. And we're seeing a lot about bone broth popping up in the news these days, even to the point of having coffee shops, but they're now bone broth shops popping up where people are walking around sipping bone broth through the day.
Now, wait a minute. Is that happening any place outside of Brooklyn? I'm just wondering.
I know. I have to find out. I mean, I live in a small town on the West Coast in Southern Oregon, and I wish it would happen here. It is so popular. And that is, we talked about coffee, so I'm offering this as another good replacement for folks to sip on throughout the day that is really filling you up, right? And
okay.
So this is something that I recommend people do. We call it the eternal pot of bone broth, so an always simmering pot of bone broth. So a slow cooker is what I use, and I know Instapot is also very popular these days. But the method that I use is to saute. You can do either grass-fed chicken or grass-fed beef bone-in. Saute it in a little bit of coconut oil. You put it in the slow cooker, and then you add about 2 carrots, 2 celery stalks, an onion. You fill it up to 2 inches above the ingredients with water, super simple. I like to add a capful of apple cider vinegar. And then you can also add either thyme or rosemary. And I'm obsessed with thyme. I love the smell, so I always do thyme. You put the lid on. You turn the slow cooker on to low. And you let that simmer all through the day, so at least 8 hours. What that does at the end of the day is you have a meal that you can take out. So you can take out and eat the meat and the veggies as a meal at the end of the day. And then you can set the bone broth aside. I should have mentioned, too, that you can add a little bit of garlic in the last little while of cooking, too, for extra flavor and extra goodness for the immunity. But you set the bone broth aside, and you can use that in other soup recipes as the base. You can also use it to cook and fortify your grains, but my favorite thing to do is to just sip on it through the day. And it has wonderful restorative properties for the gut. It also contains glycine, which works to relax the nervous system, so talking about that relaxation response. And I feel like it's one of those things that you can really sip on and you feel the color in your cheeks coming back and you really feel yourself built up.
And so, from your standpoint, it doesn't matter whether you're using beef bones or actually you're saying the meat itself with the bone in. So it doesn't matter whether it is chicken or beef broth that you are creating. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's correct, yeah. That's absolutely correct. I think each has different properties. I think playing with it to see what are your favorite flavors, you can certainly do the recipe with just the broth, or pardon me, the bones also. And if you are not a person that loves to cook, absolutely going to your health food market, whether you have a Whole Foods in your neighborhood, whatever that looks like, and just getting it pre-made is also great, too. But I think that this is a simple recipe, especially in a slow cooker, that doesn't require a lot of prep and a lot of effort and also provides a meal at the end of the day. So I love to share that recipe.
And it has a wonderful aroma that permeates your house, and it's just
exactly.
It's wonderful to smell all throughout the day. So you can't go wrong. Well, thank you so very much, Catherine Flynn, for being with us today on Creating a Family to talk about your book, Cooking for Fertility. And also, I know people will want to get more information about you and your services on fertilefoods.com. You had mentioned to me before the show began that the book is available there as an ebook, and a second edition will be coming out, and then, of course, will be available on Amazon, or you can ask your local bookstore to order it as well. But if you want to get it right now, and I recommend that you do, you would the best bet is to go to fertilefoods.com and get it as an ebook. Thank you, everybody, for being with us today. I will see you again next week.
Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and 4 precise water levels, just $4.78 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more do it. U.S. only while supplies last. See Astro Extra, see store for details, valid through April 17th.
Come to the Home Depot this month and you'll learn a thing or two. Actually, 3, with 3 free do-it-yourself workshops. Learn how to design and care for your container garden by selecting the best soil and aesthetically arranging your plants. Learn how to install tile flooring, even how to keep your outdoor deck and patio space in the best shape possible. See, it's never too late to learn something new. Register today at homedepot.com/workshops for a do-it-yourself workshop near you. Only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing.